This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
I hope this is a good example of the kind of work that we're going to be doing in this project. And it's both a kind of, for some of you who may not know some of this broader history, a lot of it is published in lots of other sources, along with a couple of other things that I found in my digging. And it's also not only kind of telling you what is recorded in the histories, but also kind of reflecting on how we have told these stories. So sometimes I'll kind of talk about particular passages that come from our histories and challenge the way that those narratives have been constructed a little bit. And so this is about the two Reverend Fontaines who both played crucial roles in the foundation of this church. A lot of this is drawn from, there were two kind of published histories of St. David's. And the first one was published in 1942. You'll see it here on the left. It's called St. David's Through the Years. It was a product of the Works Progress Administration. And it's a lovely and actually very thorough history in many ways. It counts all of our early rectors, goes through some of the material that has been collected in the archives. And that was a very important foundation for the second history that was published in 1976 by Daisy Tanner, that some of you may be a little bit more familiar with. I also wanted to note that both of these histories are digitized in the Portal to Texas History Project, if you want to ask me about where that's such a wonderful resource. So you can find the full text publicly available if you ever want to look through those yourselves. But some of the information I'm sharing comes from these, and then some of the quotes come from these as well. So our first rector was the Reverend Edward Fontaine. And I'm only going to include a few details of his life. He was quite a distinguished person. He was kind of, his family was well known before he came to St. David's, and he continued to be pretty well known afterward. He was born in Virginia, 1814. He was the great grandson of Patrick Henry. So that already kind of establishes him as one of, the United States kind of founding families. He goes to West Point. He is admitted to the bar. He starts practicing as a lawyer. But then in 1838, he's becoming active in the Methodist Episcopal Church, and he's admitted to the ministry there. And he is comes to Austin first in 1841 when he serves as the private secretary to President Mirabeau Lamar. And so that was sort of the occupation that he had those couple years that he was in Austin. But he's also starting to organize Sunday school and starting to preach to audiences that are white audiences inside the Capitol and Black audiences outside in the Oak Grove. And that is referred to in both of our histories. I wanted to kind of note, of course, that these were intentionally racially segregated services. And I also wanted to, just as a kind of reminder that, you know, in the Republic of Texas, all of those Black residents who are out there on the Grove, most likely the vast, vast majority of them were enslaved. The enslaved population made about one third of Austin's population at the time. And we also know this because in the Republic of Texas, slavery was not only legal, the Constitution of the Republic of Texas made it that you could not emancipate your slaves without permission of Congress, and free Black persons could not reside permanently in the state without the permission of Congress. So So I emphasize that just so that you know how difficult it was to be Black and free in the Republic of Texas. So to continue with Edward Fontaine's story, after his Lamar's term ends, Fontaine goes to Mississippi. And this is where he kind of enters the Episcopal Church formally. And he's ordained in 1848. And he helps found another church there, Grace Church, in Canton, and helps become a kind of founding member of that. And it's one of the interesting things, he's definitely kind of a founder of multiple parishes in his life. So St. David's is just one of many. And you can see they have a nice plaque there at Grace Church that notes his role in being their rector. And then, of course, he returns to Austin and helps to organize Episcopalians who are living in Austin. Austin is now firmly established as the capital of the now state of Texas. And so they have kind of firmer foundations and resources, they say, to build a community, and ultimately, of course, to build the physical church. But Edward Fontaine definitely helps organize these Episcopalians and becomes the first rector of what at that point is called the Church of the Epiphany in 1851. And he continues to do some of this other work as well. He serves as chaplain for the Texas Senate. A lot of his sermons are published in the area papers and other lectures on Texas history, on the natural world. He's a very prolific orator and writer. And so he continues that work in Austin. And he is an effective fundraiser as well, because some of those public speeches were to help support the building of the church, which is then completed and consecrated in May of 1855. Tragically, though, at that time, you know, his wife had become very ill. So actually Fontaine cannot attend most of those consecration services during that weekend because of his wife's illness. And she dies just 2 months after the church is consecrated. And then about a year after the church is consecrated, the church splits. And about 20 parishioners and their families who identified as Unionists, they left the Church of the Epiphany and they formed their own church called Christ Church. And they ask Reverend Charles Gillette to be their leader. He would later become the next rector of what then becomes St. David's. That's a story for a different time. It's a good story too, so I'll share it at some point. But so they start meeting in what was the new, at the time, Travis County Courthouse. And that split would continue until July 1859 when Fontaine leaves to return to Mississippi. And one other thing I wanted to note about this split, sometimes in later years when we talk about it, I've heard it referred to like this is a split between slaveholders and abolitionists. It's not quite accurate. It was definitely a split between secessionists and unionists. So secessionists were, of course, those who were anticipating that if Lincoln, as a Republican, which is, you know, the Republican Party was an anti-slavery party, if he came into power, that slavery would be abolished and they would need to secede. And so they were advocating secession. The number one reason was to uphold slavery as a legal institution. Unionists, on the other hand, they thought we should stay united with the United States, but they were not necessarily against slavery. And some of them actually were enslavers themselves. They wanted to stay part of the U.S. partly because they thought, well, we're going to need the federal, the army to help protect us from the Comanche, you know, and if we separate from them, we will be less secure. And they also thought, well, if we really want to continue economic development in this area, you know, keep in mind, Austin had no railroad lines at this point, no telegraph, you know, this was very, very remote. So they thought the best way to economically develop Austin was to stay part of the Union. Some of them were anti-slavery and abolitionist, but it's often difficult to know because people were very, very rarely public about that. And that is because it was very dangerous to be openly an abolitionist in the state. That people who did so were often chased out of the state, and some were killed. So one of the most well-known examples was Reverend Anthony Bewley in 1860. He was an ordained Methodist missionary. He was suspected of being an abolitionist, and he was lynched for this. So this was a dangerous time to assert any kind of open anti-slavery sentiment. All right, so now to kind of conclude the story of Edward Fontaine, after he leaves Austin in 1859, he marries Susan Taylor Britton, she is a widow, and she has some wealth from her previous husband, and then shortly after, Fontaine serves in the Confederate Army. He's a captain, and then he's a rector at several other churches, both in Mississippi and Louisiana. And so he continues to kind of serve in multiple parishes. And this is when we get the first kind of clear records of, so I haven't talked about Edward Fontaine as an enslaver so far, but he definitely was in the 1850s. But we don't really know how many people he enslaved at that time, because it's not in the census yet. So in 1850 and 1860, when you filled out the census, you filled out one part, and then there was a separate part of the census called the slave schedule. And that has a listing of, you know, the so-called owners would list their names, and then they would list the number of people that they enslaved, and they would list their ages and their gender identity and their race. And it's really from those records that it's probably one of the kind of few ways that we can kind of know a little bit about how many people, you know, people enslaved. So in 1860, Edward Fontaine comes into the 1860 slave schedule, and you can see that source in the background of this slide. He listed 45 people that he enslaved in Mississippi. And they range in age from about 70 to 1 year old. We don't know any more about these people. These slave schedules, they very rarely listed names of people. And so, you know, when we're trying to find histories of enslaved peoples, it's very, very challenging because there are often no names. But this is the one kind of clear record we have of kind of numbers of people. And then he lived in Mississippi for the rest of his life, and his last years, and died in Belvidere, Mississippi on January 19th, 1884. So now I want to return to St. David's and talk about how we start to learn about the other Reverend Fontaine, Reverend Jacob Fontaine. So he is mentioned in our church histories. And I'm going to read to you how he's mentioned in the first history, the one that was published in 1942. And it's on page 24 of that history. It says, "Faithful old Jake, Fontaine's Negro servant, cleaned and filled those lamps." This is the lamps of the building. "They shone brightly at the start of evensong, but in a breeze they smoked, and as the chimneys grew blacker, twilight descended within the church building. deepening almost into total darkness as the service concluded. Jake had another part in these services, a small part performed importantly and with suppressed excitement. As hastily as his conception of dignity allowed, he would rush up the aisle to help the rector remove his white surplice somewhat as a retainer might have held a king's cloak. Yet this duty failed to occupy Jake's mind completely, for after hearing the sermon, he would repeat the words of the rector, almost verbatim, from the pulpit of his own Austin Negro Baptist Church later that evening. As the pastor of that congregation, he even repeated his master's gestures, "Would the Spirit of the Lord throw in?" The Baptists of Jake's flock considered rejecting him when they found that he had been partaking of the Holy Communion with Episcopalians, but after much discussion, he was allowed special dispensation. So that is how Jacob is mentioned in the first history. In the second one, he is also mentioned, but a more abbreviated version of that story. I have looked around to see where that comes from. Unfortunately, neither of our histories have any citations, which as a historian, I can tell you is slightly frustrating. I'm going to continue to dig, but I haven't found the source of that, where the writer of that history got that information. My guess, it was that an account of a parishioner at the time, a white parishioner at the time. There are many reasons to suspect that this is not really an accurate narrative. And mainly it's because of the way that it's framed. So the language that is used in that narrative is very, very similar to other narratives like this that are called kind of faithful slave narratives. So these were often circulated in the early 20th century, and they were kind of part of the, we call the lost cause ideology. So this romanticized view of the Old South, where enslaved people were happy, and where enslavers were kind caretakers. It was a way to absolve white Southerners of their role in slavery, and it was popular in everything from you see it in Gone with the Wind, right, and you see it in many other kind of popular accounts of the time. And this narrative is very much like that. You can notice one thing I noticed is in the first one, it doesn't even use the word slave; use the word servant. And so that in itself is kind of an evasion. But it's also this idea that Jacob Fontaine would be so enamored of his so-called master that he would, take his cloak as if he were a king, and then just kind of imitate his words in his own sermons. That is definitely, part of this kind of ideology of complete loyalty of the enslaved. And it's simply not correct. And I think when we learn more about the life of Jacob Fontaine himself, we will understand why that's not an accurate way to describe him. So let me talk a little bit about the Reverend Jacob Fontaine, who lived a long life, 1808 to 1898. And a lot of this information is taken actually from a wonderful biography that was written partly by the account of his grandson, another Reverend Jacob Fontaine III, and a journalist, Jean Bird. And this history is actually at the Austin History Center and is also pretty available for public to read, and I encourage you to do so. So we estimate he was born in Arkansas in 1808, and little, unfortunately, is known about the time between then and when he comes to Austin and is enslaved by Edward Fontaine in 1851. Of course, we do know that while he was enslaved here, he served as sexton. We also know that he preached in the afternoons in the basement of the Methodist Church at Brazos and 10th Streets while he was enslaved. And then that's about all that we have, you know, based on, and so there is this piece that's in the St. David's history is a kind of valuable piece to know about Jacob Fontaine's history, but unfortunately there's not much more to uncover about that particular time. We know much more, of course, after emancipation. One other thing we do know is that, so Edward Fontaine leaves for Mississippi in 1859, but Jacob Fontaine stays here. And I haven't really kind of been able to find out how he stays here. You know, again, those years between Edward Fontaine's departure and 1865 are a bit ambiguous, but we do know that he started attending the First Baptist Church in 1860. And we also know that in 1864, he started to meet with other members of the Black congregation to organize their own Baptist church. And the Austin American Statesman noted in a story that on June 19th, 1865, Jacob Fontaine was ordained as minister in Travis County. So that is the original Juneteenth. And I think it's this wonderful kind of thing to celebrate. So on this weekend that we are celebrating Juneteenth, we are also celebrating Jacob Fontaine's ordination to the ministry. So after emancipation, he does so much work, so much important work. One of the first things he does is form the first colored Baptist church in Austin, 1867. And you can see the plaque there that honors that. We know that, you know, he's married. His wife is named Melvina. And they had four children. And his biography goes into a lot more detail about their family lineage that follows. 1876, he established a newspaper, a Black newspaper called the Gold Dollar. And it was one of the first in the South and the first under Black ownership in Austin. And that is not all that Jacob Fontaine did. There is so much more that's published in so many other sources. And as part of when we share this work in written form, we'll share resources where you can learn much more about Jacob Fontaine's life as well. But he was active in advocating for educational institutions. He was active in politics. He was particularly active in founding a number of other churches in the city. And you can see here just a list of the churches that he founded. So you can see six churches, and then the St. John Regular Missionary Baptist Association, also in 1867. And he was also a leading Black advocate for the establishment of the University of Texas at Austin. And you can see this map, you can see where the locations of those congregations throughout the Austin area. So my other question, though, given, you know, Jacob Fontaine has widely been written about in other sources, but there has been so little known about what did he ever say anything about his time at St. David's? Did he ever say anything about the Episcopal Church? And there's not much to find. As far as I have found, neither Jacob nor Edward Fontaine ever wrote about the other in their correspondence. So there's no recorded accounts of them in either of the records that exist. So we don't know really how they spoke of each other after they parted. But the one piece I did find, I think, is particularly important for us to know as members of the Episcopal Church. And this came as a product of, you know, Jacob Fontaine was very active in politics right after the Civil War. And he was part of this group called the Texas State Central Committee of Colored Men. And they met, they had about 10 conventions. The first one is in March of 1866, and that's where Jacob Fontaine served as president of that meeting. And they were really, this was a time when the state as a whole was constituting to write a new constitution, which they had to do as they were getting reintegrated into the United States. And so they were offering their recommendations and looking out for the welfare of newly freedmen in the South. And in this meeting in March of 1866, apparently Bishop Alexander Gregg, who was the Bishop of the Diocese of Texas during that time, he had written to people in the North seeking funds to get resources for formerly enslaved people, including resources for schools, for hospitals, other kinds of institutions. And at this convention, what they said is that they did not think that Bishop Gregg could be trusted with these funds, and they did not think that those funds would go to the benefit of the formerly enslaved people. And we find out more details about this from the letter that they wrote, and they had to write it to the New York Tribune. So this is a letter to the editor published in the New York Tribune, because it wouldn't be published in any kind of mainstream Texas press at the time. And so they're writing to challenge Bishop Gregg's request. And I'm going to quote part of this. "By what authority Bishop Gregg makes this appeal for material aid for the freedmen of Texas, he does not state. And so far as we know, he has no authority, certainly. He has none from the class he proposes to benefit. And if we desired funds for any purpose, we should never appoint Bishop Gregg to solicit them. Bishop Gregg is known throughout Texas as one of the earliest and most uncompromising secessionists, a bold and relentless persecutor of Union men, and who exerted all his private, personal, and ministerial influence to precipitate the rebellion, to give force to the ordinance of secession, and to keep up the spirit of resistance to the United States. As a slaveholder, he was known to be a cruel and hard master, and his former slaves today never regarded him as a friend to the colored people. And they, in turn, hated him for his oppression and for his untiring devotion to a cause, the object of which was the perpetual enslavement of their race. We return our thanks to Bishop Potter for the interest he manifests in our welfare, but we assure him that such a bishop as Bishop Gregg, whose hands are still red with the blood of martyred patriots, can never have our confidence or respect, and therefore he can be of no service to the freedmen of Texas." So as you can see, this is a very clear condemnation of Bishop Gregg. It's also a condemnation for the state of Texas, because during that constitution, they had decided that in their large state common fund for education, they had decided that none of that would go to Black residents of the state. And there are several remarkable things about that statement, but I think, one of the things to keep in mind is that this was definitely a challenge to the kind of paternalism of a lot of white enslavers, to say that, we don't need Bishop Gregg to kind of advocate for us. If we request funds, we will request them directly. And that he, among many, are sort of not to be trusted. And what I really love about this also is that we do see what this one kind of instance of the voice of Jacob Fontaine himself. He was the first person to sign that letter. And so we can know that those sentiments are his own. And I think it's one of the many examples of the ways that, while in our kind of histories, there was this kind of imagining of somebody like Jacob Fontaine as kind of imitating the person who had enslaved him, really what he did as his role in minister, what many other Black ministers did, was they made the church into a space that could nurture them. And they transformed the church into a space that could be nurturing. They created their own songs, made sense of the gospel as a source as a resource for them, both during enslavement and afterward. And they demanded that, you know, the church be a space of of transformation and of political change. And this is a really, really important thing to remember about the Reverend Jacob Fontaine, and kind of more largely about the Black Church, that this was a transformational movement, and really challenged the way that the white church was practicing. And I also think about, you know, how do we reflect on that today when we think about, you know, how do we reckon with this history? And I don't sort of have all the answers to that, but it does make me think about how we tell our story. So, you know, we often tell the story of how we were kind of a shelter from the political divides of the Civil War. And unfortunately, I don't think that's quite accurate. You know, in the decade before the Civil War, our church was split, and it really was because a number of members of our congregation did not feel welcome. Unionists did not feel welcome in the Church of the Epiphany and felt that they had to create a separate church. Now, the church does reunite during the war under Reverend Gillette. And as I said, that's its own kind of story, and it does kind of hold together in that regard. But, you know, we also talk about the church as a place of refuge, but this was not a refuge for Jacob Fontaine. And that is something that we need to acknowledge. You know, today we're honoring Juneteenth as a new national holiday, but I think this celebration would be hollow if we didn't recognize the long struggle to get there, you know, that it took a war so that Black Americans could be free. And the struggle did not, unfortunately, they were still not free at that war. It took General Granger to come with Union troops 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation to actually enforce it in Texas. And it would take many months after that for it to be fully enforced. And there would be a long struggle against white supremacy that would follow that, as I'm sure all of you know. And so there is much more work to be done. And this is just a reminder, this kind of truth telling is an effort to kind of let us know what happened so that we know what our obligations are in the future. And I know it comes at a time when some political forces don't want us to tell these things, to talk about these things, because they make us uncomfortable. You know, there, if we don't, we are not only perpetuating the injustices of the past, we're also, I think, kind of denying ourselves an opportunity. And here I'm going to kind of close with another quote from Bryan Stevenson when he talks about that justice and reconciliation and repair can be beautiful. And we deny ourselves the opportunity for beauty when we don't acknowledge the past. So with that, I'm going to stop my screen share and give us a little bit of time for discussion. And I hope that to hear what thoughts and questions and comments from the rest of you. So, thank you.
Well, I'll just start out and say, Laura, that was really well done. And it's very helpful, I think, to start the ball rolling, to see that some of these things that we have always heard, you know, to get the truth-telling aspect of it, and to show how you did a very sensitive job with this. And I think that is, you know, thank you for your leadership.
You're welcome. Thank you. any other kind of questions or thoughts, comments?
This is Dan. Laura, thanks. I think talking about the complicated legacy of Bishop Gregg remains really important. And so this work at St. David's is important. This is part of what Bishop Doyle is trying to do. He said that part of what the work of the Diocese of Texas is doing in racial healing reconciliation is reparations work because of Bishop Gregg's reputation as a slaveholder. Even with Bishop Gillette, with the reunited parish, when Diocesan Council was held here with the Diocese of Texas as a Confederate church diocese, Bishop Gillette was censored by Bishop Gregg for not audibly saying amen after the prayer for the Confederacy and President Jefferson Davis. And so the tension, I think, even in the parish with the rest of the diocese remained during that period of time. And I hope we can find a way to unearth more about Bishop Gregg's legacy. I think you've shown a really good pathway here. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm fascinated by that story as well. And I know that Gillette published his correspondence with Bishop Gregg to after he essentially left the church because of that conflict, or he left St. David's because of that conflict.
Laura, Jen?
Yes.
All right. I know that a common practice in the 19th and 20th century during slavery and post-slavery was kind of renting people out for public works projects or for building projects. So if X person were a slave owner, he would rent someone for a year or for a month to do hard labor. Mm-hmm. Do we know about how St. David's was constructed and if there's any sort of, maybe it wasn't built by slaves, but it was like forced labor. Did you come across anything related
to that? I haven't yet. You're going to have to, Joy is really looking into that, but I don't know if Joy.
I'm trying to figure that out this summer. The histories that are referenced, one of the histories, I think it's the more recent, says, we don't know who the contractor for St. David's was, but that may be just as well because some of his relatives might still live in town. St. David's did not come in on time on construction. So I'm working to dig a little bit further into that. We'll get back to you on that.
But you're right, Mark. It's quite possible because a lot of buildings in the 1850s were built by enslaved people because their enslavers would, as you said, hire them out. So it's quite likely.
Laura, this is Ellen Jackish. I'm curious if I know that St. Mark's and San Antonio, there's some very old churches in Texas, Episcopal churches. Are they doing any sort of, do you all know, are they doing any sort of work on their history along these lines?
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. Every time I talk to people, I hear some other, another church that's really starting to do this work as well. So it's quite possible, but I hope so. That's, we talk about kind of wanting to serve as a resource. I think that I'm hoping to kind of both share what we learn and also learn from other parishes and how they're engaging with, mm-hmm. with these historical projects. But I don't know about St. Mark's in particular.
I'm going to pop in here. This is Lizzie Burr. Hi, Ellen. Just not specifically exactly right answer, Laura, but this is where I, as a non-historian, am hoping to be of service on this committee to finding and developing ways of connection with both within the diocese outside And I've been particularly active over the last year through Zoom with churches in New York City that are some of which have done really impressive work. So there are lots of models for doing this that this group, this working group is now part of. And I hope that we can bring that awareness both methodologically, but also to growing we might call it the beloved community.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's what I was thinking.
And Rob Cochran, and Doug knows Rob far better than I do, did this work in Richmond, Virginia. And so he will be speaking. That's the adult formation. I think it's in August. It's not adult formation. I mean, it is adult formation, but not during this hour. In August, I think, maybe from 2 to 4. I don't know if the date's hammered out on that, but that would be a very interesting conversation to be part of, because I know that this conversation in Richmond, Virginia was fraught, to say the least.
Yeah, Rob is scheduled for August 22nd.
Thank you.
Hi, Laura, this is Diane Davis. Thank you so much for your information this morning. I wanted to ask a question about the land that St. David's is on. I recently saw a Vassar College graduation, and they started the service with a land acknowledgement. And it was actually written by the Delaware Nation and talked about how that they had been forcibly displaced and that everyone there had benefited from that, and the intent to do better in the future. And so I wondered if the historical arm of the anti-racism task force had any plans to take a look at that part of our history?
We haven't talked about that, but I love that idea. I think we should talk about that. I've seen that. I know the University of Texas, like the Writing Center, has a land acknowledgement. Several other institutions have had these land acknowledgements as well. And so I think that would be, a wonderful thing to work on as well. Thank you, Diane, for that suggestion. I really like that.
If I may be vulnerable for a moment, I want to say that a year ago, as a person of color at St. David's, I personally was confident that a lot of the anti-racism conversation was going to fizzle out quickly, as I've noticed with many other things we live in this news cycle where what's the next hot drama to talk about? And it's brought a lot of joy and confidence in me to see that that was not the case, that people are still showing up. And for me, as someone in Austin, Texas, in Texas in general, as a person of color, I don't always feel welcome and encouraged every place I go into. So seeing how many people wanted to be here on their time off, where you could be somewhere else to discuss this and learn from this and ask questions, it's been very empowering and encouraging. So I hope everyone knows, just by showing up today, even if you don't say anything, you've at least helped this member of the congregation feel welcome, empowered, and encouraged, both as a member and with Christ. So I want to say thank you for showing up today.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Vincent. That was beautiful. It's really
appreciate. And I'm a Powell. That's my maiden name.
Any other questions or comments? I'm really glad that you are sharing your ideas with us as well. You know, as I said, this is kind of the beginning of long work. I do want to note that we will have another conversation about the kind of policy-oriented part of the anti-racism task force work on August 22nd. So we will kind of continue that conversation. I want to make sure that this is, we know that this is all, you know, that we'll have a fuller discussion of more contemporary kind of issues at that point. Any other members of the history group want to say a little bit, or I don't want to force you to talk, but if you wanted to share, I know all of you have contributed really wonderful insights in our own conversation. So,
am I unmuted?
Yes.
Okay, I am just kind of curious where St. David's is now on people of color in our congregation and in our membership. Do we have any record of that, any knowledge of that? Do we know how many people? I mean, we do seem to be predominantly white, so I was just curious if there's any idea how much we've diversified our own population.
I don't feel I can answer that question, Beth.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody. I just wondered if it's even been looked at. So,
yeah.
This is Chad. I think, you know, it's absolutely something we talk about, but it's not something we have great numbers around or can track over time necessarily, mm-hmm. just because of the way our member database, you know, is collected and identifies people. So any attempts are purely just based off of, you know, looking in the pews and kind of off of a sense of who's there. But I will say we're also, as a part of this movement, we're also working on anti-racism training for all of our staff. There's going to be a more detailed, in-depth focus for clergy and program and kind of the music ministry teams. And the plan, I think, is for us to go through Sacred Ground together, just so we have a shared vocabulary with all the members of the congregation who've been through that process. But then follow that up, too, at the end of that, with a real focused, and the diocese is going to help us with this, a focus kind of asking the question of, so, you know, what do we do now as a staff and as an organization in response to what we've learned? As well, at the same time, we're going to have a focused anti-racism training really for all staff. So for the entire staff of St. David's, and that'll be something ongoing as well. You know, we're not sure yet that the timing of all of that. The diocese is helping us to formulate a plan for all of that.
Okay. Well, it looks like we're at 11 o'clock, and I know that a number of you are going to in-person services at St. David's, I miss seeing all of you in person, and I look forward to seeing you again. Thank you so much for coming, and there's, you know, we'll share the work and I encourage you to reach out to any of us if you want to, you know, talk further, and, you know, as we continue to do this project. Thank you so much.
Can we have a prayer going out?
Oh. I'm gonna let the experts do that. Does anybody have a prayer to share?
Does anyone else, Dan, or I know we have some others, if anyone else feels called, or I'm happy to, but the Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Loving God. Lord, we thank you for this opportunity to come together and to learn our history, troubled and challenging as it may be. Pray that you would cause us to leave here changed with our eyes open, but also, more importantly, Lord, help us to continue this work. Pray that you would use your hand to guide us, that this is a long journey that we are beginning, and it doesn't end today. We pray that you would leave this place with us and would use your hand to guide us as we continue to find ways to bring change, to be an ally, and to be anti-racist in our work. We thank you for this time and for this day. We ask all this in your son's name. Amen.
Thank you, Chad.
Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.